It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Father, he waits.
Much to learn. Much to teach. There are dangers beyond our village.
What a wonderful day!
They're taking your clan.
You chose a human over an ape.
This was a human place.
It is not yours.
It is now, isn't it?
The elders did not tell us everything about this world.
Nor bend for your king.
Never.
Tickets now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as usual, I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Sean Whalen.
Glad to be here as always, my friend.
Glad to have you. And we are doing a Planet of the Apes episode, so of course I invited Mr. Zaki Hassan.
Hi.
How's it going, Zaki?
It's going.
Yeah, it is. And we have Mr. Scott Gardner here. Yes, in his full simian glory. And usually we have Richie with us, but he begged off this one and said he didn't think he had a lot to add, so we added Logan Gardner.
Hi.
A young bonobo.
I didn't get much of the monkey genes, I guess.
So, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now, I only got to see this once, and I saw it a few weeks ago, but it made enough of a lasting impression that I think I have a good feeling for discussing it. You know, I made a point the first week it came out, I had to go see it on the big screen because there hasn't been a Planet of the Apes movie yet that I haven't seen on the big screen. And, yeah, you know, it didn't really disappoint me. I'm going to, you know, we'll get a little further into it, but I enjoyed it. And it was, you know, it was fairly long. It was, 145 minutes, so almost 2.5 hours. And I did not feel that 145 minutes. I thought it went by fairly quick. And I'll give you my just initial thought was it was almost a contradiction in terms, because initially it felt to me like we're getting a new world and new people, and it's, you know, it felt very different to get into it. And yet there were things about it that were somewhat formulaic, not necessarily in a bad way, but it felt new and different and formulaic at the same time. So obviously it's an oxymoron for me, but I had both feelings as I was watching this. And that was one of the things that I enjoyed about it, was, you know, treading new ground, but giving us some old stuff and hitting some story beats that I could just really enjoy. And I'm going to just, before we get into details, throw it around to the panel and see what everybody, you know, what their first impressions were. So why don't we go in the order I introduced you, and we'll go right over to Sean. I mean, yeah, Sean, excuse me.
So, and Paul, you call me out on this one all the time. There's certain movies that I really like to see on the big screen. And it's usually ones with some form of spectacle. This is one of those movies that's like meant to be a summer spectacular. And it has that kind of big screen feel to it. A lot of it is, for me, due to the environments and kind of the way that they were crafted. I wanted to feel the vastness. To your point, Paul, where you were saying some of it felt new, but also some felt formulaic. I want to feel like I'm in this world. And I think they did a great job developing something for the screen that made me feel like I was brought into that world. This is what I want from a big screen summer movie. And that was kind of my initial impression for it. You're right about the time for this one. When I saw it was going to be 2.5 hours, I'll admit I was walking in and I'm like, ooh, 2.5 hours, that's going to be a long one. I didn't feel that when I was watching it. And we'll talk more about the story and or just our overall feelings about the story overall. But I think it's a compliment kind of initially I can give it, is I didn't feel the time. I don't know if everybody feels that same way, but I think that will be an interesting discussion point as we go forward.
All right, Zachy, did you do this one in the previews, or did you see it with like the rest of us common folk?
I went, they had like a day early, like a fan screening. I watched that with most of my kids. And then I've seen it 3 times at this point. So my wife wanted to see it, so I went with her. And then my oldest son, he missed it. So I was like, well, twist my arm, I guess we'll go watch it again. And certainly I hope that conveys that I absolutely love this movie. I think it's a fantastic addition to the mythos. It does so many things well. I don't feel it needed to be as long as it is, but just to echo what y'all have said, I didn't feel that length. And it in addition to telling a very compelling and grossing story on its own that carries forward what the Caesar trilogy did, it also puts a lot of pieces in place to make me excited for what's going to come next. But unlike many other franchises, it's not, you know, the post-credit scene, so to speak, not figuratively, is not the most exciting part of the movie. It's the movie itself is very engaging, and it's like, plus there might be some more fun stuff coming too. So it's a real cornucopia for me.
All right, Scott.
I tried to go into this one as cold as possible. Not, you know, I was trying to avoid spoilers. I didn't really watch. I think I watched one trailer for the movie, unfortunately did spoil a big plot. Well, we're not spoiler free. It was the fact that the female could talk. That I didn't like that was spoiled for me ahead of time. I would have rather have found that out during the course of the movie. I wasn't sure what to expect going into this, but I had low expectations because I'm easy to please when it comes to apes. I just wanted more apes. I was thrilled that, you know, that we were getting another apes movie. I will confess to some sizable disappointment that this isn't directly connected to the other movies, as far as like this isn't a continuation of Caesar's bloodline. I mean, I know Caesar died in the last movie, spoiler, but so I knew fully well it wasn't going to be Caesar, but I kind of thought it was going to be his son was Cornelius, right? I was thinking it was going to be Cornelius, or maybe like a descendant of Cornelius. And so the fact that, so far as we know at this point, that Noah's completely, you know, unrelated and really didn't know anything of Caesar was a little bit off-putting to me. But I tried to mentally, once I realized all that, I tried to mentally deal with that by basically looking at this very much like the old Marvel black and white magazines, where you had like the primary feature, which was usually an adaptation of one of the films. And then you had, you know, the original stuff that was being done. And before that stuff got really weird and wacky and kind of silly, there were some interesting stories being told in there. And I really liked that stuff. It wasn't the A material necessarily, but it was fun in its own way, because it was just more apes. And that's kind of the approach I've mentally taken to this movie in retrospect. I really kind of want to see it again, because my initial thought walking out was, I wonder how this is going to hold up in rewatches. Is it going to be as rewatchable as like the original three, and the three of the newer movies, the reboot movies? So that's kind of where I was with it. But overall, I was just happy to get more apes.
What'd you think, Logan?
I think I could say pretty much the same thing. I wasn't sure what to expect walking in. I think I expected it to be an almost immediate sequel going off of where it left off in the third one. Maybe being with his son or even grandson, but it's like at this time we're not sure what the relation is with Noah, you said?
Yeah.
That was the other thing. I don't remember anybody.
Yeah, that was kind of a criticism that Logan and I both had after the movie. It was like, can you remember the name of any of the characters? And I had to kind of struggle for that. They didn't make a hell of a big impact, other than the orangutan, which I still can't remember his name. He made an impact as a character on me, but like the main character is Noah. And I just found him kind of bland. I didn't honestly really care what happened to him the same way I was seriously invested in Caesar and his survival and his triumph. Did you feel that way as well?
Yeah, I didn't dislike him, but I also wasn't gripped by his character.
Right.
Well, let's make that kind of our first point to discuss then. Because I had some thoughts along those lines too. A little different from the two of you, though, because I thought it took a little while to warm up to Noah as the movie went on. And that was one of the things that kind of let me be more intrigued by what was going to happen on the screen. Ultimately, I thought it was a fairly good decision, because I thought they were going to pick up almost where they left off in the last movie. But I think by doing this, I found myself a little bit more, paying a little bit more close attention than I might otherwise do, because I was curious as to who is this character and what's going on with him. And as will become apparent, I found this movie to have a very typical, when I said there was some predictable parts to it, I found it to be a very, very typical hero's journey type movie. And I found myself comparing it to Star Wars from, the original Star Wars movie. And when I started thinking of it that way, and I started comparing Noah in my mind to Luke Skywalker, I found, because of that comparison that I was making, I found him to be a more appealing character. And then as the movie went on, and he kind of matured in some ways. I don't think he really had so much of the story arc as a maturation, because I don't think his story arc is completed yet. So I thought when we went through his maturation and knowing there's going to be another movie, I found myself latching on to him even more. And he could have easily failed me, but as it turns out, I've come to like his character very much because of some of the reasons that I'm talking about now. What did you guys think of him, Sean, Zachy?
So I like Noah, but like you, it took a little while to warm up to. I enjoyed the initial journey of the three of them, him and the girl, which was it May? Did I have that right?
May.
May, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and just by the way, the big orangutan was Raka.
Raka.
Yeah. And so I liked their initial quest for the eggs. I'm in two places. It's funny, as Scott was talking about the Cornelius story that he wanted to see, I was like nodding to myself going, well, I actually really like to see that story too. But where I think it worked in this film, and in particular with the journey of Noah, because we as the viewer didn't know how we got here, in Noah's case, we're going on a journey of discovery. And as you're going through it, we have some gorillas who have this idea of what's or are manipulating Caesar's legacy to their own ends. And then we have Raka, who actually knows the real legacy that we as the viewers know. We don't know, like, how did this all get lost? How did we get here? I want to see that story. I want to know what happened. I'm a big fan of Caesar's legacy. I want to know what happened to his kids. I think, though, for the purpose of this film, what intrigued me was wanting to find out any nugget I could. You know, when we came across Raka, I thought that was where the end. I wasn't thinking of him as Obi-Wan until Paul threw in the whole Star Wars piece. But I get the reason why, Paul, you made that connection. And I found, like, he was bringing back it. Okay, this somebody at least gets what I know about Caesar and all that, and they're bringing it in. I found that that part of the journey started to become much more engaging and connecting. That being said, as Scott was telling, like, the story that he wanted to see, all I was thinking to myself was, like, I want to know what happened with all that, too. I like legacy. I like knowing that piece.
So, I think a lot of that could be filled in through, like, novelizations of things and additional stories. I don't know if they have to actually make that into a cinematic thing.
I like that kind of stuff too, though. I like support pieces. You can make it a comic book. You can make it a novel. You can make it an audio play. Whatever you want to do. I would love to. I'd just like more, and I'd like to see some of that. But for the purpose of this film, I like the mystery.
Now that you say that, I'm going to have to hunt and see if they've already maybe started doing that, Paul, because there is a novel. There's at least one novel apiece between Rise and Dawn, and then Dawn and War. And both of those books are fantastic and really shade those movies in nicely. So, yeah, I'd like to see if they've already started. Hopefully, if they haven't, they will shade those areas.
That's a good place where Rich Handley would have been good here, because I'm sure if there was, he'd know.
Yeah.
What'd you think of Noah and Owen Teague's performance as Noah, Zachy?
You know, he won me over right away. The motion capture effects have been, you know, like with each movie, it's more and more impressive. And it's like, you know, it very shortly into this, you know, 2-3 minutes in, I'm just like, I'm forgetting that I'm watching actors. I'm like, no, I'm watching apes, you know? And I made the Star Wars connection fairly early on. I was like, oh, okay, they're doing Star Wars. Like, it was, for me, it was like way before Rock or any of that. And so I just keyed into that right away. And I was like, I kind of love this. And I was looking at it in terms of, like, what's kind of great is that somebody coming in completely cold could jump in with this movie. And the great thing is they would be in the exact same position as Noah. So they would be discovering the information the same time as him. And it would allow for a journey of discovery in this film, and then the opportunity to be like, oh, but here's three more movies. You can go back and see all the backstory. And I really liked that. I applauded the decision to jump so far ahead because exactly kind of what you're alluding to before, where it's like, you know, there's an opportunity later on to fill in that story and see what did happen with Caesar's descendant and stuff. I'm not saying that's not a story worth telling, but I like that this one, and Wes Ball has said as much, he's like, if we did that, if we just, oh, Caesar's son, then it's calling too much for a direct comparison with those original three, which are very well regarded. And the opportunity here was to say, well, this is a story set within the world, but it's a totally different story. And that's, you know, ever since War for the Planet of the Apes came out, that's what I've been saying. I'm like, we got, you know, if we look at sort of the milieu of the Heston movie as roughly, not exactly, but roughly an endpoint, you got 2,000 years of story you can fill in. And, it's not the Caesar franchise, it's the planet is the main character. So let's jump around. Let's do all kinds of stuff. You know, I hope we can do a trilogy after this that's set in, you know, Europe, and see how did things go over there. You know, I mean, that's what I'd like to see.
That's an interesting perspective. And my one thing is, I just never want this franchise to get ahead that 2,000 years and get to the Icarus landing on on Earth. Now, I'll tell you, and this is a silly nitpick, but one of the things that actually bothered me is that this movie takes place on the West Coast. As silly as this is, because they found the doll in there that says Mama, and they had all the books there, and all I could say is, this is the Forbidden Zone. This is the cave they went into in the original Planet of the Apes movie. You know, there's the same stuff there, and at some point, there should have been a shot of the Statue of Liberty, maybe partially covered or something, and that would have been a connection to me. So having it take place on the West Coast just seemed too coincidental with the doll and everything. And again, it's a nitpick, and it really is just calling for, you know, an Easter egg that I didn't get, but I would have loved to have gotten it.
But in this world where it's all this happened not because of nuclear holocaust, how would you explain the Statue of Liberty on the West Coast? How would that all sync up?
I wouldn't explain the Statue of Liberty on the West Coast. I would have had to take place on the East Coast.
I got you. Okay, I got you.
And you know, yeah, George Taylor does yell, "You blew it up, you maniacs, blah, blah, blah." But do we know that there was a nuclear holocaust? We don't know what caused it. That could have been 2,000 years of erosion that turned the Statue of Liberty into what it was.
See, I have been waiting and dreading one of the creators behind all this new stuff saying exactly what you just said, because I don't want them to backpedal from that. At some point, if they're ever going to link these up, and they don't have to link them up, I'm perfectly fine if this Apes remains as kind of an, you know, like keeps winking and nodding at the original timeline, but never actually connects to it, I'm perfectly fine with that. But if this is all leading to the original Heston film, there's got to be a nuclear war, nuclear something at some point, because I just, that's what everybody believes, I think. But plus, now if you take, say, Beneath into account, clearly something happened with radiation and everything to bring about the
mutants. Okay, and everything. But there could be a nuclear war in this world that we have here anyway, we never have to see it necessarily. We already have, with the little Easter egg at the end, the little post credit scene that's before the credits, we see that there's a human faction, and they could be the ones who ultimately set off some sort of bomb. We don't know, and we don't have to know.
I kind of had the feeling.
I think the war is still coming. That's my feeling. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I kind of had the feeling that post credit scene might have been in a nuke bunker or something like, that thing that John Connor wound up in at the end of T3. You know, like the survival. Right. You know what I'm talking about? Something like that. Yep. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they're headed that way and maybe thinking those things. That was one of the things with this that I'm a complete sucker for the post-apocalyptic movie where the apocalypse happened quite a while ago, and now you're seeing just glimpses of our civilization through that mirror, through that lens, where the people that live there don't know what this object is, but we look at it and go, oh, that's the Statue of Liberty. I love that. I love that stuff. But one of the things I really was hoping to see, because this movie really gave me the vibes of those old Marvel black and white Apes magazines, was the mutant creatures that had emerged And that's another one of those things I don't think we're going to get until and unless the whole radioactive, you know, post-nuclear thing gets introduced, you know, because we saw that kind of sparingly, as I recall, but we did see that, you know, along with, you know, the mutant humans, there were also mutant animals, and I kind of like that. I wish we had gotten at least some glimpse of that in this, that, you know, that there were, the other things were happening. You know, not only had apes gained intelligence, but maybe other animals were beginning to kind of change as well. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't want to see like in Commandia, you know, we don't need to have talking tigers or anything, but I'm just talking like new species of animals that have mutated from, you know, because of the virus, whatever. I don't know. That's just one of those post-apocalyptic things I love, and I was really hoping we might see that in this.
I'm going to say, you know, again, I gave you one nitpick, and I'm going to give you my other kind of weakness, because I really did like this movie, so I don't have a lot of complaints about it. I thought that the followers of Proximus Caesar could have been a little bit more well-developed, particularly Silva, the gorilla who's got a hard-on for getting Noah. You know, all they show him is as he's an acolyte of Proximus, and for whatever reason, he really wants to beat Noah senseless to death. And they don't really give him much more depth than that, and I would have liked to have seen just a little bit more personality out of him. And I'll get your thoughts on that, and I think that's pretty much it for my real criticism of the movie. Anyone?
I agree with what you're saying about certainly the Silva character. I feel like there was kind of a, I don't know, it's hard to explain. It felt like that character's arc might have been better served by giving some of those beats to Proximus. And I think, you know, it felt kind of redundant in that regard, because, you know, it's like the final showdown should be much more impactful for Noah, right? And so Silva's the guy who killed his father. And then, so he's out of the way. And then, oh, by the way, there's Proximus. And I feel like there could have been an opportunity to just merge those characters.
Or you could have, I mean, I know we're already almost 2.5 hours of a movie. There could have been maybe a scene after we're introduced to Proximus, maybe some sort of flashback scene or a little bit of dialogue or something where they mention how, you know, why he's so loyal to Proximus. What did Proximus do for him? Something. I thought that would have given him just a little bit more motivation, and it would have made it a little bit more, given a little bit more depth in a movie where most of the characters have some pretty good depth. I got to say, you know, I really feel like they developed some of these characters well, and I'm going to jump around on a few of them. I'm going to go to Raka first, because, boy, is there a cooler character in this movie? Because if there is, you'll have to tell me.
I liked him. I liked him a lot, and I sure hope he's not really dead. You know, some folks might feel like that's a cheat if he just shows up, you know, later on, like, you know, that's, you know, predictable or whatever. But I, you know, I'll totally forgive it in this case, just because I loved his character.
I thought he was going to show up later in the movie.
Yeah, I did too. I kind of thought that might be the post-credit sequence, honestly, but. You know, he's the only character I genuinely did love in the movie. Like I say, I got nothing against Noah. He was kind of bland to me. It's funny, the whole Star Wars thing, because I didn't really put that together consciously, but he did remind me of Rey from essentially the Star Wars remake. So there was that connection in my mind, But Raka, I genuinely really liked. And I think it was because not only do I have a soft spot for the orangutan characters, all of them that we've ever had in these movies, I've always liked the orangutans. But he was just likable. He was kind of lovable, but he was also the connection. He was the connection. You know, he was the one character that seemed to know of the old world and how all of this had come about. And so he was important in the narrative to me anyway. And yeah, I was sad that you know that they did him the way they did. That was emotional. That was the one emotional scene where I was like, okay, I feel something with this.
I was going to say that I hope, because this is hopefully a trilogy, which is, I know that their intention, and they've actually talked about another trilogy after this, if this all keeps going well, which I wouldn't mind seeing based off of this film, because there's a lot more. I felt like this film left me with things I wanted answered. That, to Zaki's point, we had a 2.5-hour film. I don't know how much more we could have packed in, but yet there are questions out of this. Raqqa either surviving or there being some echoes of Raqqa, I mean, his teachings, like, you know, somebody finds books or something. Because Raqqa had this knowledge bank that was traveling with him. It'd be really a shame if that is lost in this world as it goes forward. I just think that there's something interesting there, and I'd love to see him somehow make his way to Noah's group and be a part of that. Because one of the things I did find interesting about Proximus's group, just to kind of go off the question earlier, was this idea that Proximus is trying to absorb any other culture that he comes across and make them drones to just serving his purposes and his people. And I'm with that I would like to know a little bit more about, like, his hierarchy. And if they are just drones too, or if they actually, you know, if he has people that are advisors other than just knowledge bank for his quest to continue this power, because it'd be interesting to see if there is somebody, you know, if Proximus didn't survive, which I'm guessing he didn't, you know, that if there's somebody that could rise up, somebody that has that kind of power, because that's quite the society that was left behind. Either to splinter off into other things or for somebody to be an opportunist and to take over as we look at the future of this. I don't know where that's going to go, but I'm intrigued by that. And we aren't left with this successor, at least in my mind, like this engaging successor. I'd like to see what that journey is after this as well.
I have a question for Zaki. You gotta forgive me. We've only just seen this the once, and it was quite some time ago now as we record this. But am I right in remembering that Raqqa had said that he was part of a I don't want to say a cult, but like a group?
Yeah, the Order of Caesar.
Yeah. Okay. So,
but I think
so
he said he was the only survivor of that order.
He's the last one left.
Oh, okay. So I was going to say, if there were more of his people, then he doesn't necessarily have to survive. But if he was the last one, then yeah, I do hope he survived.
He's Obi-Wan Kenobi. He was the last Jedi.
Yeah, the last Jedi. Yeah.
Yeah, we see he points to a friend whose body is in a funeral pyre of some kind. He says, with him gone, he's the last one, basically.
So, Kevin Durand as Proximus Caesar. Now, the first question I have is maybe somebody knows. When he gets up to give his speech, when he's first introduced, and he says, "Isn't this a beautiful day?" You know, he gives it very, very boisterously. And it seems to me, you know, he's getting his teaching from Trevathan, or how it's pronounced.
Trevathan,
excuse me. And I'm thinking maybe that's something in the history books. Maybe that's something, you know, Julius Caesar would say to the crowd or something like that. Does anybody recognize that comment as having any meaning? I guess not. But I bet you that that's from somewhere, that he's, you know, he's trying to ape, excuse the pun, a story that he's heard and somehow become a great leader, you know, like trying to you know, use the words of some great leader in the past and try and make himself beloved that way. Now, he's played again by Kevin Durand, who I knew initially on the TV show Lost, where he played a character, I think his name was Kimmy or something like that. And he was very threatening and very good. And then he was the Blob in Wolverine Origins. Yeah. I thought he was great in this. I loved his line delivery. I, you know, it was... Yeah. I go back and forth on villains in movies. Sometimes I love the ones who are very, very subtle. You know, your Anthony Hopkins, who just plays it, who underplays the role and is more threatening because of it. And then sometimes I love the ones like this, who are chewing up the scenery every second they can, and making a meal of it. And I thought that's what he did here. And I thought it was perfect contrast to the very, very low-key Noah and his attitude. What'd you guys think of him, his character, and his effectiveness in the movie as the villain? Anyone?
I thought he made for a good villain. He has that trying to be imposing and powerful aspect, but I think he maybe doesn't realize he's not as strong as he thinks he is.
Now, see, I think a little different than that. I think he's got some insecurity, and he knows he's not as powerful as he's pretending to be, and he's trying to develop that power. That's why he's so desperate to get into this bunker and get whatever weapons or knowledge that he can get from there. And that's the way I saw him played. Okay, I guess nobody had some deep thoughts on him.
I'll give him credit that I was very curious what the threat or antagonist or whatever was going to be with this movie, because again, I tried to go in as cold as possible on it. And so I will give them credit that they went that direction, that it was another ape faction and not just more, more humans, of the last of the intelligent humans, or however, it wasn't the military. It wasn't anything like that. It was, the humans really are on the back burner now. And this, this is the Planet of the Apes. So any threat going forward seemingly is going to have to come, from in their world and not, be humans. And so I give them credit for that. So, yeah, I think that kind of goes to Sean's point. It's going to be really interesting from here, without there being any clear successor to this guy. What's going to happen now? Now what's the next thing going to be? What's the next threat?
I didn't quite realize that myself. Of the first three, you go from it being apes versus humans, of the humans not wanting this takeover and trying to fight it and literally going to war with the apes and trying to fight the disease and everything, to now, all this time later, you have what goes against what Caesar wanted of apes not kill ape, and now apes are killing apes. They're fighting against each other.
So it subverted your expectations there, because you didn't expect the apes to. You would expect maybe different political views, maybe a little discourse, but you don't expect them to be enslaving and killing each other.
So Logan, and you saying that just raises something that I really wanted to ask you guys about. Did your pre-existing apes knowledge get in the way at all during your viewing of this? Because it did for me big time, because as soon as I realized the threat in the beginning was another tribe of apes that come in and literally murder Noah's people, my ape knowledge is screaming in my brain, wait, what happened to apes shall never kill ape? And that really hung me up for a long time in this movie, until that kind of sort of got addressed, that I guess that's just not a thing yet.
And no, if you think about the original five, Ape Shall Never Kill Ape is created by Caesar. Mm-hmm. And it's the Caesar of that movie. But it's done in his lifetime. So now if you're trying to somehow connect these things, this is however many years after that, and that philosophy could have been crushed somehow.
Right.
It's some of what Proximus is doing, though. I was actually, sorry, I was looking up, like, when you said the What a Wonderful Day reference, I was just looking it up online, and oh my God, it's become this TikTok sensation. So the problem is trying to find, like, some nugget of the origins of it. It's really hard because it's become a whole bunch of silliness, too, which is fun. I mean, that people were that intrigued by it. But I was looking over an interesting article where they were talking about how it's almost Proximus twisting some of Caesar's thoughts about apes being stronger together into, I've dominated these other tribes now, but look at what's happened now. Because we have all of these resources, all of this power together, look at what we're able to do. And he's showing this wonderful, you know, gathering of all of them together and how they're able to now, you know, break through, you know, now we're going to break through this other secret and we are going to continue to grow and thrive under, but he's twisting completely, as we know, as viewers, he is completely twisting what Caesar was really trying to do. So I was just looking over that piece and trying to see that it really is. He's using philosophy that was there before. And we know this is flying in the face of what Caesar was really looking for here. Mm-hmm. So those pieces are there. It's not like it's discounting what came before. It's the time passage. That's where I want to read a tie-in. I want to know all that stuff along the way. And even if they don't get it, I think when there's lore available there, I think part of this world and why we like the orangutan so much is because he's a connecting thread to the pieces that we want to know. I mean, I love that history. I want to know more about it. He's kind of our linchpin, pin. Like, that's our guy.
Well, if you kind of go with the orangutan theory and you think about when, Dr. Zaius was our orangutan through those first two movies, he knew more than he let on. He was smarter than everybody thought he was brilliant, and he was even smarter than they thought he was. He knew more than he let on, which is eventually, what's his name? Dr. Hessline in the next movie. But there's this element of the orangutans just being wise. You know, we had that in the first three movies with Maurice, and now we had it with Raka in this one. Yeah. Were you going to say something, Zaki?
No, I'm agreeing with you. Yeah, I mean, I think that to Scott's point about prior ape knowledge, and I was like going over it. I was like, how did that play? Like, did the movie work for me because of my knowledge of the franchise, or did I have to shunt it to one side? And I think what I would say is I was having fun engaging with the ways in which this film both echoed prior, ape canon and sort of, swerved when I expected it to go one way or the next. And that was the fun I was having. And I think part of it, I think it's been helpful with these three films, just be like, well, this is a reboot anyway, it's doing its own thing. So I remember going in when I was watching Rise the very first time, I was like, so is this meant to lead into the 68 movie? And how specific is that supposed to be? And it's just doing its own thing. And so it's all little echoes, it's echoes of Jerry Goldsmith's music. It's echoes of that's not even an echo. It's the actual baby doll crying sound, and it's all just fun for me, like the little call outs,
Oh, absolutely. That was one of my favorite things. The hunting with the scarecrows and the Jerry Goldsmith music. And the Jerry Goldsmith music, when they were playing, or at least the recreation of some of his music, I tapped my wife and I said, oh, this is the music from the first one. And that's not something she would really be paying attention to. But she was like, oh yeah, I hear it. Like without me saying that to her.
Logan called it out. Yeah. When we were watching, he goes, did you hear that? Cause I think it was the horn that you heard that, right?
Yeah. The Rams horn.
I can't remember exactly when it was, but there was a certain part where I was like, man, this sounds a lot like the original, the original Apes movies.
Yeah.
This is an instance where the score stood out to me, and yet it did so in a favorable way, because usually I like the score to be subtle and just kind of carry me through the movie and not really think about it until after I've seen it.
One of my few trepidations going into this movie was finding out that Giacchino was not returning as the composer. You know, so he had done both Dawn and War, and I dare say I think it's some of his best work. And that's really saying something, because the guy has done some absolutely phenomenal film scores. He's, in a lot of ways, I think he's the next John Williams. But anyway, you know, finding out that he was not scoring this movie, you know, that was one of those things that made me really nervous. And then when I found out that it was John Paisano, I'm like, ugh. Now, nothing against John Paisano, but my only touchstone with him was he scored the Daredevil series for Netflix, and he scored the Defenders series. Was that a series or was that a movie? I forget, but whatever, the Defenders. And I have those. I've listened to them. They're just kind of bland. So I thought, ooh, you know. But I've spent the past couple of days listening to the score, you know, for this movie, you know, just isolated from the film, and it's growing on me. It's actually really good, and I feel like he did a very, very masterful job of kind of both blending Giacchino and Goldsmith's classic original score, but then also creating his own thing out of it as well. And it's really good, and it's interesting. I have to keep listening to it to see if I'm right about this, but I feel like it starts heavily homaging Giacchino, but then right about the time of the hunt, where it's most obviously homaging Goldsmith, from that point forward, it seems like there is a tonal shift in the score to go more Goldsmith and move away. So it's like it shifts. And that's really interesting, if I'm right, but I'm not sure I'm right on that. And I think I even heard some tiny homages to the other composers as well, but I'm not positive on that. But it was a really good score. It was one of the things I was most impressed with the movie was the music, because it worked really well in the film, but it's nice to discover that it's a pretty good standalone score on its own, too.
Yeah, I totally agree. Usually I wait till the end of the talk to talk about the score, but I still have two characters that I definitely want to discuss. And the first is Trevathan. Now we've had this conversation in the past where we've talked about like Walking Dead and things like that. And I said, you know what, if I'm in the zombie apocalypse, I'm not going through my life just terrified that these things are going to come and bite my neck and kill me. I'm probably just going to find the easiest way to painlessly just kill myself and get out of this thing. You know, because deep down inside, I'm a coward. I'm not going to try and pretend otherwise. And I think Trevathan is there for the people like me. Because if I'm captured by the apes and they're saying, read me these books and tell me what they say, I'm probably reading them the books and telling them what they say. If they're going to let me live a comfortable life because I did that. Everybody saw him as a villain in the piece, and I certainly understand why. But he's not just a simple villain for villain's sake. He's not Grimer Wormtongue. He's got a reason for what he's doing. You know, he's William H. Macy. He's 70-something years old. He's not, you know, this kid who's going to go on a crusade to teach everybody how to fight the apes and reclaim, you know, the world for humanity. In fact, he comes right out and says, this is already their world. There's nothing we're going to do about it. And he's just finding himself the most comfortable way to live in it. And he's happy to have himself as be like one of the advisors to Proximus, who, you know, who's held in high esteem by him. So I'm kind of cool with his character, and I thought it was well played. Yes, he makes bad decisions, and yes, he's not likable. But, you know, if our planet falls under the rule of apes, I might not be likable either.
Who says you're likable now, though, really?
True.
I don't know. How did you feel about him? I didn't like him, to be honest. But I don't think you're supposed to.
Yeah.
No, you're not.
I agree with that completely. I don't think you're supposed to like him. I forget, does the movie tell you how long it's been since, like how long of a time gap it is? Does it say in the beginning?
It's been 300 years since Caesar died.
Okay.
Oh, they did say that?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Because I kept waiting for that, and because it seemed to me like they were kind of playing a little fast and loose with it. Like sometimes
it's in the, at the beginning when they have the words on the screen giving you a little background.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I don't remember that. Okay.
He almost comes off as somebody that existed, like maybe he was a kid when the whole thing happened. So he's just like, well, they took over. That sucks. Get used to it.
But now this is the only world he's known.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, but
maybe it doesn't work when you think about it that way, that he was born into it. Why is he like, well, can't do nothing about it. It's hard to explain, but it doesn't work.
Well, here's my headcanon I'll give you. He was part of some sort of human tribe that survived the whole virus. And through the generations, they lived in this area. And he learned how to read and learned, you know, they had all these books and whatever. And he was a learned person. And then Proximus and his apes came over and took over the area and probably killed all the other humans that were there. And he was willing to serve them in order to elongate his life.
Yeah. He probably didn't want to fight, but also didn't want to die. So he's like, I'll do what you say. Yeah,
he talks about it in the film. He was trying to make his way to the coast, and he ended up taking a tumble and shattered both of his ankles.
Oh yeah,
and so at that point, the only choice he had was to survive by serving Proximus. And I'm sure part of that is the justification he's building up in his own mind, because he has that great conversation with May, and May says, you know, well, I'm the one who's not helping the apes. I know that, you know. So people do funny things to survive. You know, I think I talked about this on my show with my co-host, and that character, Trevathan, really, I found him fascinating because, you know, he illuminates something maybe unpleasant about human nature, is that, you know, collaboration is easier than resisting, and sometimes we create these sort of moral justifications. And it drew to my mind the original novel, the Pierre Boulle novel, where the main character, Meru, he learns of these experiments on the humans in that planet, where they delve into recessive memory of, you know, the generation of humans that first was overtaken by the apes. And you have the humans essentially saying, you know, I'm forced to live in a cage now, but, you know, it's not so bad. And, you know, the apes, they treat me well. And, you know, and sort of like the main character has this realization where he's like, it's not like the humans fought them. They just gave up, you know? And so Trevathan, to me, is illustrative of that sliver of humanity that finds, you know, as long as I'm taken care of, it's okay, you know?
But I think Trevathan also justifies it in his own mind, saying, the apes have already taken over the world. There is no resistance for me to join.
Right.
So I'm kind of, you know, he is not a likable character, I don't deny it, but his motivations are somewhat complex, and I think they are, you know, he becomes a three-dimensional character because of that. And then when he sees what they're doing, he's thinking what they're doing is hopeless. They will not change what's going on here, but they're going to ruin this good thing that I have. And that's why he's ready to turn them in.
Right.
You know, if somehow you could convince him that what you're doing has a chance of success, maybe then he turns.
What I did find intriguing about this is knowledge and history, and it does actually tie back into, I think, the history of the Planet of the Apes in general. Knowledge and history is both viewed as currency when convenient, but also as disruptive and should be hidden in other cases. And I think this series, like this idea that there is a larger world out there, comes up, and he's one of the characters actually that opens that doorway, that there's more out there than we're seeing in this film. We're seeing certain areas that, yes, have large impact, but as we start to see, there's other human colonies that are out there. And we know there's got to be more out, you know, more of the apes that are out there in various configurations. I would love to know more what those look like, but who knows what? In the 300 years that have passed, what do the humans know? You know, are there any human colonies that know what has happened in 300 years? Has that knowledge survived anywhere? The order that Raka was a part of, is Raka still there? Is any of their knowledge documented anywhere in any form? Is that stuff that is going to appear in pieces or in its entirety? Has it already and somebody's hiding it? Those are things that if we don't see them in the next couple installments are going to be, I think to me, are missed opportunities. Because I'd really like to see that stuff. I'm intrigued by it. And, you know, with the time passage can wind up being a very cool thing in this if in two parts, two and three, depending on who knows what and how they utilize it or hide it for the purpose of, you know, moving forward this particular story. If they miss that opportunity, I think something interesting will be lost, because I agree with anybody who's been saying that Raka was one of the cooler characters in this film, because stands when he was like floating away, I'm like sitting here, I want to throw him a rope. But I mean, that was a great emotional moment. And I think it's because of that knowledge bank and history, he was that connecting thread. I don't think he's the... It'd be a shame not to see some reference back to him in the past, but I don't think he's the only possible point for connection to that 300 years of the past. And what's intriguing in this one is, as with the other ape series, finding human artifacts has had tremendous impact on what has happened in the Planet of the Apes movies as we've gone forward. So there's still a way for the story to get out. The true story of Caesar, because nobody really has it. They have echoes, as everyone's mentioned before. They have those pieces there, but that doesn't mean the humans don't, which is intriguing.
Definitely.
Yeah. Zaki, anything?
No, I agree with what Tom said.
Okay, every once in a while, I see, you know, the different people's boxes light up something, and I thought maybe something to say, and you were interrupted. So the last character I wanted to talk about is obviously May, who is really intriguing to me as well, because you constantly want to think of her as pure, and she constantly shows you that she's not. But she's got an understandable motivation as well, but she's walking that line between hero and villain through the whole movie. And you know, she also was the cause of my favorite line in the movie. And that's when Raka says, we'll name her Nova. We name them all Nova. That was my favorite thing, just cause I got a kick out of that. But you know, early on, you know, she's pretending to be one of the mute humans, and then it comes out that she can speak. And when it comes out that she can speak, also, you know, the first thing she says is Noah, but to me, I kept hearing Roddy McDowell saying, when he gives the history of when the apes took over, and he said no, and that kept ringing over in my mind. But then it's that not only that she can speak, but she's extremely intelligent. And then we find out that she's got other motivations, and that she's not necessarily in line with the apes that she's allied herself with. That her, you know, her goals are different, and she's willing to you know, break off that path at any point along the line. And then at the end, when she's talking to Noah and she's got that gun behind her back, and I'm told that was shot two different ways, and one of them was very clear that her purpose was coming there to assassinate Noah because they saw him as a threat. So she's a very complex character, and I'm still, having completed seeing the movie, still not sure if she's a hero or a villain in it. But her motivations are understandable. She's looking to get the humans back what she believes they belongs to them.
That's why I think the humans have a knowledge bank here that is going to connect to some of the history that we've been looking for. She knows their history and the fact that there was a point in time before all of this when humanity kind of led us down this path through choices. And I'd be curious to see where that goes. I kept rooting for her, as you do in these movies, you know, for her and Noah to be best buds at the end of this kind of thing. And I actually liked that it didn't work out that way. Sometimes I like fresh takes on things, and I like when things don't necessarily go where, yes, it's strange to say, where I was hoping. I wanted them to, you know, hoorah, be buddies, her to go back to their village, and maybe, you know, they're kind of rebuilding what Caesar was doing. And I kind of like that just because of what happened between them and what they experienced, she betrayed him in a certain extent, you know, and then there's a broken trust there that he's got to go back, and this his tribe and his culture and his family, he's got to go back and protect it. In many ways, that's what she's trying to do. So there is some similarity between the two of them, except she broke a trust that I don't know that they ever truly had, because of the fact that she was using him for her own purposes and had her own intentions. But I just really liked the two characters. I found that part, as the film went on, I found there were things I was getting intrigued by as the movie went. So it's one of the reasons why when I looked at the timestamps on that one, I don't know that it could have been any shorter, because I think if they cut certain things out of this, they would have lost me. I think the journey, you know, by the end, there's things that make me want to see a sequel. I would like this to be a trilogy. I want to know where this goes. I want to know more about this larger world and the echoes that they were, you know, the tethers that are out there, the tendrils that we didn't get to see in this. And it's important when you're doing a first movie like this to leave your viewers with that. Otherwise, your sequel is not going to do very well at all.
Now, did this do well enough that is still the plan?
I thought it did well.
It's doing fine. It's made more domestically than the last two films, and it's held well. I mean, I was at the theater this past week, and we're more than a month in, and that joint was packed. So that part of it is anecdotal, but it's reflected in the drops from week to week, which have been very solid. I mean, it's holding well. And you know, the reception to it has been very good. So I suspect within another couple months, we're going to get an announcement for a sequel.
I certainly hope so. So in a movie where apes can speak and humans mostly can't, the thing I found unbelievable was that the satellite dishes still work 300 years in the future without any maintenance at all. Because I don't know, I have electronic things, you know, I have a CD player from, I don't know, 20 something years ago that I hadn't used, and I plugged it in and it didn't work anymore because it just, you know, time, I guess, wore away its belts and whatever else were in there. And yet 300 years from now, these satellite dishes work. But you know what? I can accept it. Whatever. it leads me to be intrigued as to what we're going to get next. And that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about this movie, because, you know, we're going to get in a minute or so to rating it. And I have to tell you, my rating is higher in anticipation for what we're going to get than it would be if I thought this was a standalone movie. Mm. So, you know, I mean, I really enjoyed it. But I do think that the intrigue of what's to come really just adds to it. Now, you know, I mean, obviously we have to rate it for its own self, but I do see part of this movie as building blocks to go forward and yet still making a self-contained movie. So I thought, you know, I don't think that's an easy feat. I think when you're putting stuff out there that's already there for the sequel, it's hard to make it feel as self-contained as it does. So, you know, I applaud that aspect of it. But before we rate it, does anybody else have any aspect of it that you'd like to hit on?
Well, I hope and pray that there is a solid plan, that these things that were dropped, and these hints and these glimpses and these teases, you know, you had made the Star Wars analogy, and that keeps sticking with me, but it keeps sticking with me more from a Force Awakens perspective than a New Hope perspective. And so, you know, Force Awakens did the same thing. It set all these things up and then famously shit the bed with the next movie. So I hope that's not the case here. I hope that these things were set up with a clear plan for payoff or expansion or whatever down the road, and that they're not just winging it. Like, the next guy's not going to come in and you know, do a Rian Johnson on it and just totally ruin, you know, whatever comes along onto that. You know, and of course, you know,
your totally mind agrees
on how you feel about, you know, the Star Wars sequels, but you know, my point is, I hope there's a master plan already in place, or at least a rough sketch type of thing, and they're not just winging these. You know, one.
I'm not a sequel hater the way some people are, but I do see the lack of a plan, and it does irk me. And I got to think, as both Disney properties, maybe Disney learned a lesson from last time, and maybe at least has an outline for where the trilogy is going to go before they produced this first one. Zachy, do you have any insight on that? Because you know more about these things than we do generally.
Only that Wes Ball has spoken to the idea of having something mapped out. Certainly this is something that Rick Joffe and Amanda Silver have spoken to. And I don't know how heavy their involvement is in these films. But, I mean, they've spoken to and Sean mentioned this, about, you know, essentially a 9-film saga, you know, when all is said and done. Given that Disney, I have to imagine, is acutely aware, they have to know of the flaws with the Star Wars sequel trilogy, foremost among them being sort of the baton toss, you know, nature of it. I think that there's probably something in mind, and you know, they probably have room to deviate from it. But yeah, I don't think they're flying blind on this one.
I would tend to agree with you. I just think, you know, when they look back on the criticism of the Star Wars sequel trilogy and then combine that with what they've probably lost in, you know, video streaming and different money that they could have made from that third trilogy that they probably planned on making down the line, and the fact that these characters aren't as viable to move forward as they would have hoped, I think they have to have seen all of that and said, you know, we have to do better with this one, and I have some confidence that they will, because this seems like a solid foundation. And that said, I'm going to say I really enjoyed this a lot. I enjoyed it more than I expected to. Much like Scott, I kept my expectations. I didn't keep my expectations low, because I expect a lot out of every Planet of the Apes movie, and I'm usually not disappointed. I'm looking at you, Mark Wahlberg. But just, you know, for the most part, I enjoy all of them. And I definitely enjoyed this as well. So my expectations were still there to enjoy it, but I did not have any advanced spoilers as to what was going to go on in the movie. I really didn't know what we were going to get. I didn't know that it was going to be generations in the future. I didn't know any of that. So I sat there and I was pretty much totally, you know, pulled in by the movie. I don't know that I could give it a Jaws rating, but I really enjoyed it. I do think that it will hold up to repeated viewings. And I get the feeling that if this trilogy is as strong as I'm hoping, it's going to even be better for repeated viewings than it is already. So I'm going to give it a high Jaws too. I really enjoyed it. Who wants to take the ball next?
I'll be happy to. As far as, I couldn't agree with you more on it being a Jaws too. And there's some key reasons for me on this one. Actually, some of it was what Scott was saying before, so I'm gonna give credit, because I'm stealing a little bit of what you were saying earlier with Force Awakens. I really enjoyed that movie. I thought, as kicking off the start of another Star Wars trilogy, I thought it did a really good job of getting me intrigued and setting it up. I can't, you know, for this one, I don't have a crystal ball to see what the next two films are going to look like in this, but man, I hope that they're good, and I hope that they keep the momentum going, because this one has momentum right now, in a time where it's hard to figure out how to get momentum going at the box office. So this film has a lot of excitement for me, because I think it deserves the momentum that it's getting right now, and I hope it delivers. Plus, man, the Eagles being like the lightsabers in this was kind of cool. I enjoyed that aspect of their culture. I thought that was kind of a neat thing that they put in there. And there was enough in here that I want more. Any of the things that people were talking about, any of you were talking about that you wanted to see in this or were looking for in this, I'm hoping we get in the next movies in some capacity, in some way. And I think this did set up a world where those things are possible in ways that we're not thinking of. And if so, it could be a really cool story. So them giving me that hope and that excitement, I think, just puts it in Jaws 2. And actually, some of what Paula was saying earlier, if 2 and 3 are fantastic, boy, it will raise the bar even on this one for beyond Jaws 2 for me, because we get a complete story like that and it nails it. Now, all of a sudden, that first movie has a very different vibe to it. But for right now, it's a Jaws 2 for me walking out of it. And I'm hoping that maybe somewhere down the road, the whole thing just improves for me because of the next two.
Yeah. I think that trying to take what you had from the first three movies, and obviously you're trying to start the next trilogy, taking what you had in the past, what you're trying to establish in this movie as the trilogy starter, and trying to show what it continues on into with hopefully the next two movies, is a hard task to do. And I think they pulled it off very well. I love the world already, both story-wise and aesthetic-wise. It was touched on earlier, but it gives me vibes of, like, it's more video gamey, but, like, Fallout and Horizon. It gives me that sort of vibe to it. But I will have to agree, it is very high Jaws 2, and I would agree that depending on how the next couple movies go, that could change, and it would probably be a Jaws to me.
Zaki?
Scott Ozaki?
Oh, I thought Scott was going to go. I'll echo sort of the conventional wisdom here. I would say that for me, just as a fan of the franchise, I'm just happy to see them approach it in a way that feels true to itself. You know, I've said this before, that, you know, what I kind of love about these current films is that they're successful enough for the studio to keep it going, but not so successful that they're, you know, it's like on their radar to the point where they're getting their fingers in the pie. It's just, I think there's a general ethos to the Apes franchise, which, it seems like the filmmakers involved are all aware of and they're intent on preserving. And so, yeah, this is my first exposure to Wes Ball, not having seen the Maze Runner films, but based on this film and just based on what he's saying in all the interviews, I'm very happy that he's the guy currently guiding this wing of it.
All right, Scott, you want to bring it home?
Did he give a Jaws rating?
Oh no, you didn't actually.
Oh, it's not Jaws, but I would say it's better than Jaws 2.
Okay.
So it's either a high Jaws 2 or a low Jaws.
There you go. Take your pick.
Well, I'm going to echo Zaki that I'm just happy to get more Apes, because I absolutely love this franchise. You know, I enjoy all the films to varying degrees, and you know, at least a couple of them are some of my absolute favorite films. So I'm just thrilled that there is more. My rating on this is probably going to sound like I didn't like the movie, and that is totally not the case. I liked it, but that's my problem, is I liked it. I didn't love it. And I'm a little bit nervous about repeat viewings, because I really have the feeling that this is going to be one of those ones that's not going to hold up in repeat viewings for me, because it's a little long and I was a little bored in a couple of spots. And the problem with that is I just didn't find, with the exception of the orangutan, I just didn't find a character that really sucked me in. I wasn't fully engaged through the entire picture like I was with the first three, with Caesar. Those movies had me riveted. and this one didn't somehow. So I liken this very much to like a solid chapter of one of the comic series. Like when Boom first started with their series was very good and it was very enjoyable. It wasn't great, but I enjoyed it and it kept me reading, and I lamented when it was all done. And this was kind of that way for me. It was a solid Ape story. I enjoyed it, but I didn't think it was great. But I am very curious where it's going to go. So for me, this one's a solid Jaws 3. I really, this is where the, one of those situations where I kind of wish there were five Jaws films so that I could put it right smack in the middle. Because Jaws 3 makes it, again, to me, it makes it sound like I think it was a dog or something. But it wasn't. It just, it was just kind of like, okay, that was fun. You know, give me the next one. So, yeah.
All right, Scott, you're not invited back anymore. that's why I embrace differing opinions. And it sounds to me like your rating is more based on the thought of repeat viewing. And that could be interesting to see how it plays out when we get the sequels. Because, you know, a couple of us have said, those sequels could actually raise the rating on this one, and maybe it might do the same for you. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see when we get the next one. You know, we'll get together again and we'll talk and we'll see where it goes. But I guess that's it for this one. And thank you everybody for listening. Thank you guys for all coming on. It's always a pleasure to speak to each and every one of you. And I look forward to our next chance to talk together.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
See you all in 2 weeks.
What a wonderful day!
What a wonderful day!
Are we thankful for the words of Caesar?
We are thankful!
Do we bend our heads?
We bend!
Say his words! Say his words!
Thanks to God!
What a wonderful day!